tax reform and economic growth have been hot topics lately, and it was something that we felt was really important to better understand, and have reached out to some academics to get their perspective on taxes and economic growth. And so I actually just really cold called Dr. McGuire. Someone had suggested we take a look at a presentation that she had given to the Federation of Tax Administrators, and I looked at it, gave her a call, we had a lovely conversation, found out she was from Widnor, Senator Barash's district. Did her undergraduate here at UNL, and we had a lovely conversation, and she said, you know, if you ever want me to do this presentation in Nebraska, and I quickly took her up on it, and so here she is today. And so just a little bit more about her. She is a professor of management and strategy at Kellogg and the director of Guthrie Center for Real Estate Research and the Real Estate Program at Northwestern. Her areas of expertise are state and local public finance, fiscal decentralization, property tax limitations, education and education finance, and regional economic development. She's written about and worked with various governments on state tax reform and on the impact of taxes on economic growth. Dr. McGuire has worked with the Blue Ribbon Commission and directed the study of revenues and expenditures for the state of Arizona, and was president of the National Tax Association in 1999 to 2000, as well as the editor of the National Tax Association's academic journal, the National Tax Journal, from 2001 to 2009. Her publications have appeared in the National Tax Journal, the Journal of Regional Science, the Journal of Urban Economics, and the Journal of Public Economics. Dr. McGuire has a PhD in economics from Princeton University. Her presentation will last for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have the rest of the time for question and answer. And I really look forward to a vibrant dialogue on these very important issues. And so please help me welcome Dr. McGuire.
Thank you, Renee, and thank you, Renee, and the Open Sky Policy Institute for allowing me to invite myself to Nebraska. It's always fun to come back home, and that's exactly how it feels, is coming back home. And I'm really looking forward to this. I hope this will be a conversation more than anything about this important topic that Nebraska is struggling with, as are virtually all the states around the country. So what I want to talk about today is I want to look at the academic evidence for and against the statement that the effect of state taxes has an impact on state economic growth. Then I want to do a kind of a twist and look at another set of research and take a look at the question from another angle and look at the effect of fiscal policy uncertainty on economic growth. I'm going to zero in for a little bit on the case of Illinois, part because I know it very well, but also Illinois is struggling with a lot of issues that Nebraska and other states are struggling with, and maybe and in a, you know, a very they're like the poster child for a state that's not doing things well at the moment. So I think we can maybe learn something from looking at Illinois. And then I will close with my thoughts on what I think is a potentially effective economic development play for state governments. Okay? So what is the systematic evidence on the question, are taxes a significant factor in the economic development of states? So this question was a major impetus for the first time that I got involved in this was for the Minnesota Tax Study Commission of the mid-1980s. So this was a Blue Ribbon Commission appointed by the governor and the legislature of the state of Minnesota to look at their tax system. They were worried that their taxes had gotten out of line and were pushing businesses away from the state. And in particular, Burlington Northern, which was its corporate headquarters were in St. Paul, they picked up stakes and moved to the south, claiming that the high taxes in Minnesota were a major part of their decision to move. And so the Tax Study Commission was created in part because of that decision. With a colleague, Michael Wazilenko, I undertook an empirical study looking at data on the 48 contiguous states. And we observed that there are differences across the states in their job growth rates between 1973 and 1980 was the period that we were looking at. Some states grew much faster than others. And so we tried to figure out what factors could help us explain those differences in growth rates that we were seeing across the states. And we looked at lots of different factors, the average manufacturing wage in the state, the electricity costs, average electricity costs in the state, income per capita, other market factors, and then we look at public sector variables, including spending in certain categories and different types of taxes. Okay? We looked at the effect of these factors. Do these factors help to explain the differences in growth rate of total employment in the states and by major industry? Okay? And what did we find? We found that education spending had a positive and significant effect on job growth for total employment in two of the sub-industries. And we found that the individual income tax burden had a negative effect on job growth in three of the industries that we looked at. Okay? So this was other people have been doing studies around the same time, and we were kind of the first ones to find these statistically significant effects of taxes and spending on job growth. So it was kind of a big deal. People started to try to figure out what was going on. But I just want to say that we had 28 possible tax factors that we were looking for a relationship between the tax factor and the job growth. And of those 28 possible tax factors we looked at, only 8 of them were significant. Okay? So this is supposedly a big thing, but really only 8 out of the 28. So we'll come back to that. So that was one study, and then a bunch of other studies around the same time and subsequent to it. At the same time, Jay Helms did a study and he found taxes to be a significant determinant of employment growth. A few years later, Bob Carroll tried to replicate Helms' study using more recent data and could not replicate the results. I teamed up again with Michael Wasilenko in 1987 for another tax study commission, this one in New Jersey. And then Michael Wasilenko teamed up with Bob Carroll for the Arizona Tax Study Commission. And again, we were unable, using more recent data than we had used in the Minnesota Tax Study, we were unable to replicate our earlier results. And taxes were not a significant factor. Timothy Bartik did a survey of all the empirical evidence up until that point in 1991, and he concluded that the consensus was that taxes have a small but significant effect, looking at all the different results. Leslie Papke did a couple of studies looking at the effect of state corporate income taxes on investment. She found them that they mattered. Bob Tannenwald tried to replicate Papke's results with more recent data and could not do it. Jim Hines found that state taxes mattered for foreign direct investment. Michael Wasilenko and Ron Fisher did separate surveys in 1997, and both of them, of the literature up to that point, and both of them are really inconclusive, essentially inconclusive as to whether or not how we should answer that question of our taxes is a significant factor. Study by Goolsbee and Maydew looked at the corporate income tax again and the payroll factor in the formula, and found that if you reduce the payroll weight in the formula, you would boost manufacturing employment in your state. Lots of states have done this subsequently. Merriman, again, very recently, looked at using different data and slightly different specifications, found those results incredibly sensitive to the sample period selected and the specification of the model. Study by Banya, Gray, and Stone found that it's actually the taxes can be, in their empirical work, found that taxes can be too high, they can be a deterrent to economic growth, but it's also possible for taxes to be too low and be a deterrent to economic growth. And that the story there is that if your taxes are so low that you're not unable to fund spending on infrastructure and education and human capital development that's important for businesses to grow, then that too can be a deterrent to economic growth. So the main reason why I throw all this stuff up here at you is to show you that results are coming out by good, all these people are respected researchers around at different universities. Some finding that taxes matter, different studies, different samples, different time periods, and taxes matter, taxes don't matter. Okay? So I find the evidence pretty, inconclusive, pretty slippery. So I jumped back into the game a few years back with Kim Rubin. We looked at the economic effects of TABOR. What's TABOR? TABOR is the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, which was passed by voters in Colorado in 1992, amending their constitution to limit the annual growth rate of the revenues of all taxing jurisdictions in the state of Colorado to the sum of population growth and inflation. Okay? Lots of states have limits of one kind or another. This is a particularly severe limit, limiting revenue growth rate to population growth and inflation. I won't go through the details of why it's a severe limit, but one of the things is that it bases, you know, how much your revenues can grow this year is based on how much your revenues were last year. And if you last year was a recession year and your revenues fell through the floor, then that's your base that you get to grow on, okay? So in fact, during the Great Recession, the state of Colorado, the voters voted to table the tax, the Tabor, and not have it be in effect during during that recession. So anyway, it's a pretty strict limit. And why was this proposed in Colorado? Well, proponents argued that this limit would rein in kind of runaway government growth, and that would be good for the economy. Okay. Opponents argued that by reining in revenues, you would also rein in expenditures on necessary and required services, and therefore that would harm the economy of Colorado. Okay, so it was an argument about what would be the best thing for Colorado's economy. Well, who was right? What happened to Colorado's economy after the passage of Tabor in 1992 went into effect in 1993? This shows the percentage change in real income per capita from 1978 to 1993, when Tabor comes into effect, and then in the green from 1993 to 2003. So it looks like after Tabor, the growth rate was much faster. It was, in fact, much faster than it was before. Okay, so maybe Tabor did have a positive effect on Colorado's economy. Well, the problem is lots of other things were going on, and there were trends going on in the country. And if we look at Colorado, those on the left there's Colorado, what I just showed you. On the right is what's happening to the other mountain states in those exact same time periods. And the other mountain states also saw an increase in the growth rate of per capita income after 1993. Okay? So, and they didn't have a Tabor. So something, the trends are changing in the growth rate of these states' economies. But it could still be that Tabor was one among many factors that were part of the boost in Colorado. So we then Kim Rubin and I undertook a systematic look at the data, and we had a data set that covered all the states from 1978 through 2003, and we estimated a model looking at two measures of economic growth and seeing whether or not they were related to various factors like I talked about before, the manufacturing wage, the per capita income, lots of things. And we included a variable that we call Tabor passed. It turns on in 1993 only for Colorado. Okay, so we could see if the passage of Tabor gave a boost to the economic growth in Colorado. We also looked at Tabor. We created a variable called Tabor out years, which means a variable that turned on in 1998, 5 years after the Tabor took effect, so that we could see the short-run effect right after Tabor takes effect and the long-run effect. And what did we find? We estimate three different models, and we found that the effect on the growth rate, so one of our measures of economic growth was real per capita income, growth in real per capita income, and we found no effect of Tabor in the short run or in the long run, in any of our specifications. It never came in statistically significant. Another measure of economic growth that we looked at was the growth rate of employment in the states. Okay? And we found in two of our three specifications, we found a positive effect of Tabor in the short run. But in the long run, Tabor had a negative and much stronger effect than that short run positive effect. So overall, again, no effect of Tabor on economic growth. So we concluded that this tax limitation law in Colorado did not significantly boost Colorado's economy. Okay. So what's the bottom line on the effect, the evidence as I read it anyway, of state taxes on economic growth? I think the jury is still out, and it may always be out. Why? Because we don't have a very good model of what causes regional economic growth and decline. These empirical studies I've been talking to you about are fraught with lots of statistical problems, and they're difficult to overcome. And what we really need is a natural experiment. We need I don't know, the federal government to just drop, say, all right, you 18 states, we're going to limit your taxes, and the rest of you not, and then we can see what happens, right? Because the problem with Tabor, which kind of looks like it, you know, kind of came from outside and hit Colorado, but whatever caused the people to vote up Tabor could have also caused the change in their economy. So we can't separate the things out. So we really need an experiment, which I don't think we're ever going to get. So what's my bottom line? My bottom line is the evidence of a link between the level of state taxes and state economic growth is weak. It's so weak, it's weak enough that it's hard for me to believe that cutting taxes with the goal of boosting your economy is likely to be an effective policy play. Okay? All right. I just want to take a little sidebar here to talk about company-specific tax incentives. So when a firm comes knocking on, you know, Senator Schumacher's door and says, if we don't get these tax breaks from the state of Nebraska, we're going to pick up our roots and leave the state, okay? That kind of thing, or Boeing, you know, with its recent 777X plant, you know, shopping it around among states, right? So that's what I mean by a company-specific tax incentive. None of this evidence I've been talking about looks at those incentives. It's very hard to assess them, but none of it looks at it. There are lots of qualms about the practice of company-specific tax breaks. Sorry, one of them is that just a zero-sum game? Nebraska's gain is Iowa's loss, or vice versa. Okay, for the whole society overall, there's no gain. We're just shuffling economic activity and firms among the country. Is the government simply being held up like a gun to the head that the firm would have made the same decision it made without the tax incentives, and all it is a waste of taxpayer money? Does it make for an uneven playing field? This one, I think, is a pretty compelling one, that one firm in an industry gets the tax break and the other firms operating in that same industry doesn't. Is that fair? Okay. And also, there's this notion that it might signal desperation on the part of the government or on the part of the firm. If the firm needs that tax break in order to make it, it's not necessarily a good bet on the part of the state. And if the state thinks it needs to be handing these sorts of tax breaks out, you know, on a routine basis, that might be viewed as sort of a weakness on the part of the government. If that's what they think they need to do in order to stay in the game. But on the other hand, you know, when they come knocking at your door, I totally sympathize with the notion that you don't want to lose your good firms. So, despite the current tough fiscal times where most states don't have the money to be thrown around, this practice is very much alive and well. There's a very nearby in Kansas, a year and a half ago or so, the corporate headquarters of AMC Entertainment was lured away from Kansas City, Missouri by tax incentives by the state of Kansas to move into Kansas City, Kansas. Okay, that was a pretty interesting one. Alabama gave quite a huge tax breaks to Airbus to locate its first plant in the United States. Illinois drunk on these things a little bit, although they just this past year, last month, they had two. So Sears has gotten tax breaks from the state of Illinois three times in its history in Illinois. Office Max and ADM is Archer Daniels Midland, a huge agricultural company. They were looking for tax breaks for moves, and they did not get them in December of this year. And ADM stayed in Illinois, and Office Max moved to Florida. 22 states entered the bidding war for Boeing's plant, 777X plant, and they're staying in Washington because they made a deal with the unions on the pensions. And now I'm going to switch gears and look at a slightly different question, another angle. I want to look at tax and spending policy uncertainty, economic policy uncertainty, and whether or not that has an effect on economic growth. Perhaps it's not the current tax levels, but uncertainty about future tax levels that is a deterrent to economic growth. I'm going to talk about a new line of macroeconomic research. It's not my research. It's coming from Nick Bloom at Stanford and some of his co-authors. And this is looking at the effect of economic and fiscal policy uncertainty on the growth of the U.S. economy, and then we're going to try and interpret it for states. I'm also going to tell you about a conversation I had back with the Minnesota Tax Study Commission with executives at 3M. And what were they what were they most worried about in terms of the tax policy? All right, so Baker, Bloom, and Davis created this index, Policy Uncertainty Index, that's made up of, they had graduate students read newspapers over the last from the last several decades and look for mentions of about changes in economic policy. They also looked at federal tax code provisions that were set to expire. They looked at forecast or disagreement in terms of the rate of inflation and in terms of government spending. And they combined this into an index that looks like this, set at 100 in 2010, and then looks at, you know, as you can see, the, you know, at 9/11, the uncertainty index about fiscal and economic policy was very high relative to 2010. You know, the Gulf War, Clinton's election, the Gulf War II, et cetera. And you can, so then they took this index and they related it to the growth rate of GDP and employment in the nation. And what they found was they're going to look at, suppose we have an increase in uncertainty from this very low level of 2006 to this very high level of 2011. What would that increase in fiscal policy uncertainty do to the US economy? And they found that that increase would lead to a decrease of up to 2.3% in gross domestic product and a decrease of 2.3 million in employment. Okay, so those are pretty big effects. Now this is just a brand new working paper and it's, you know, just sort of brand new research coming out. But it seems to be that uncertainty in fiscal and economic policy, the direction that the policy is going, appears to predict changes in GDP and employment. Okay. Why might this be why might this happen? So the economics literature is focused on mainly on three main channels that economic and fiscal policy uncertainty might affect the real economy. And the first one is called the real options effect. This was first sort of introduced by Ben Bernanke in 1983. This is this notion of firms are not going to want to invest or hire if they're not sure what the future of the fiscal policy is. Okay? So we'll just wait and see what comes out. The financing cost, the notion here is that uncertainty can increase risk premiums, so it becomes more costly to borrow for firms, and that's of course going to hit small firms the hardest. And then the precautionary savings channel, which is the notion that people aren't, I'm not going to, if the you know, there's uncertainty about the fiscal and economic policy going forward, and I'm uncertain about, you know, whether or not my job, I'm going to have my job 6 months from now, I'm not going to go out and buy a new car or replace that my washing machine. So people will reduce consumption. And all three of these things then could hurt the economy. Here's a quote from the CEO of Honeywell. Right now we're holding back on all but the most necessary external hiring and on capital expenditures. If I can make the decision now or 6 months from now, I'll make the decision 6 months from now and see what develops. So this is during you know, November of 2012, heightened concern about what the federal government was going to do with this tax policy. Okay, this was all about the federal government and federal tax policy. Do these results matter at the state level? In March of last year, the Federal Open Market Committee, that's the Federal Reserve, their beige book where they're assessing the state of the economy, contacts in the Cleveland Fed, the Richmond, Chicago, and Kansas City district cited concerns over government regulation and fiscal uncertainty as a reason for slow growth in their regions. Okay. Now let me tell you about my conversation with the 3M executives when I was working for the Minnesota Tax Study Commission. They made two points that have stuck with me ever since. The first one is on what we're talking about now. They argued with me, they argued that it's not the level of taxes that's a deterrent to our making business decisions and the economy, we think. It's certainty and predictability. We need to know what the tax system's gonna look like 3, 4, 8 years down the line. We need to know if this, what you currently have in your sales tax code that exempts you know, firm purchases from the sales tax, is that gonna be there in 8 years from now, okay? So certainty and predictability in state taxes is much more important in business location and hiring decisions than is the level of state taxes. They also made another point back to the company's specific tax breaks, viewed them as not only being unfair, why would you give it to one company and not other companies, but also as a sign of a weak, if not desperate, government. This is where I got that idea, actually. Okay. Now, to the case study of Illinois. Illinois, in January of 2011, they were sitting with huge budget problems. Their fiscal house was completely knocked over by a tornado. They increased their income. Illinois has a flat rate income tax, and it had been at 3% for decades. And in January of 2011, they temporarily increased their income tax from 3% to 5%. It's a huge increase. Okay, so people were, this was a pretty major, and was it harmful to Illinois' economy? Did they shoot themselves in the foot? The systematic evidence that I was walking you through earlier is inconclusive and it's not definitive, so we can't look at the evidence. Politicians in other states seem to think that the answer was yes. Okay, so there's this article in the New York Times right after the tax was passed, where the governors of Wisconsin and Indiana and New Jersey said, great news, all you companies in Illinois, just come to us. We're a much more hospitable place for you to be, right? I particularly like Mitch Daniels pointing us out as the Simpsons, the dysfunctional family down the block. All right, so, well, fine. What did it do when we increased our tax rate from 3% to 5%? And also, by the way, corporate income tax rate went up at the same time. In fact, compared to these other three states, yeah, our 3% rate had been the lowest among these four states, and now it puts us in the middle of the pack. And the corporate tax rate went up to 9.5%, which is the highest of these four, but it's not, very far out of line. So for New Jersey and Wisconsin to be saying that our 5% rate was going to, drive everybody out of our state into their states was a little bit disingenuous. All right, so what did people think after Illinois did this tax increase? So the Chicago Tribune invited the governors of Wisconsin and Illinois to go at one another with op-eds about this tax increase. And they gave the win in the op-ed contest to Governor Quinn of Illinois. Here's a quote from him. Frankly, our state's unstable finances have stood in the way of business investment. Okay, so basically a statement about this fiscal policy uncertainty standing in the way of investment. If you don't know how things are going to be resolved in this state, then how are you going to make investments in the state? Maybe Illinois did shoot itself in the foot. The Wall Street Journal had an article around the exact same time, and they quoted this Christine Rees. They had a bipartisan tax commission going on at that time in Georgia. And she says, our overriding goal of this commission is to get the income tax rate as low as possible because the evidence is so clear that this is the biggest driver of growth in jobs. I don't know what evidence she's pointing to here, but the evidence is not that clear to me. What happened in Illinois? Following the tax increase, Standard & Poor's removed Illinois from its watch list for a potential downgrade, and Fitch lifted its outlook on Illinois' debt from negative to stable. Okay, so the rating agencies thought that this was a positive move for the state of Illinois. Well, that was 3 years ago. Now what's going on in Illinois? And I said this tax increase is temporary. It's set to expire in January of next year. So Illinois, they're figuring out what they're gonna do now, because of course all the money is being spent. If we go back to our old tax rates, have to cut a lot of expenditures. But anyway, what's the situation today? Well, the situation today is that Illinois has enormous unfunded liabilities. In particular, its public pension system. First of all, I'm just repeating, the evidence about fiscal policy uncertainty harming the economy. The fiscal policy uncertainty in Illinois stems from its mountain of unfunded liabilities. It has $100 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. And this is a number from a few months ago, so I'm sure it's more than around $4 to $5 billion of unfunded, they just don't pay. What they do is they don't pay their vendors, okay? So you work for the state of Illinois, you go to the dentist is gonna make you pay out of pocket because they're not gonna wait for the state of Illinois 18 months to pay that bill, okay? So they just don't pay their vendors. That's one of the things they do for their unfunded liabilities. But in any event, we were the least well-funded pension in the country. Okay, and for years, year after year after year, this was the case. Finally, in December of this past year, they passed pension reform because really the business community was really kind of they were losing it over Illinois' inability to address these big problems. So they reduced the cost of living adjustment. They increased the retirement age. There's a guarantee of they guaranteed that the state would make its annual required contribution. Illinois had not been making its annual required contribution. They had, in fact, been borrowing from their pension fund to pay for other things. Okay. It's projected to, we're projected to now, if we stay on this path, to have a fully funded system by 2014. The rating agencies changed their outlooks on the state's credit rating. They didn't change them from negative to positive. They just changed them to developing. And why is that? Well, because we're still not out of the woods. General fund expenditures in the state of Illinois are continuing to outstrip general fund revenues. Okay, and we have a provision in our Constitution that makes it unconstitutional to harm the pensions of state employees. Therefore, this law that was passed in December and signed by Governor Quinn is being challenged in the constitutional as being unconstitutional, and it may not fly. So Illinois is still a bit in limbo here, I would say. All right, so I told you I would conclude with my thoughts on what's likely to be the most effective economic development play for any state, for a state. So this, based on my read of the evidence, which could be different than another person's reading of the evidence, there's obviously debate out there. Based on my reading of the academic evidence, based on my working with various tax study commissions over the years, talking with business executives, and my answer to the question is states should devise a clear and immutable path toward paying off their debt. Okay, problem in Illinois is that debt is just hanging over like a big black cloud. And so until we have a clear path for how we're going to get out from underneath that debt, I wouldn't advise you to expand your business operations in Illinois, okay? States should devise a clear and credible plan for not taking on new debt unless it's for capital projects. That's what you should use debt for, is to build roads, build schools, build for capital projects, okay? And then states should reform their tax systems so that they adequately support in a predictable, fair way, the functions of government that are most important, in my view, to a vibrant economy. And those functions of government are the development of human capital, which is education, healthcare, public safety, job training programs, et cetera, and the provision of infrastructure, be it transportation and protection of the environment. That's what I have. Thank you.